You're listening to the FQXI podcast. The science of smell is pretty poorly understood, but at a meeting at University College London a couple of weeks ago, I ran into biophysicist Luca Turin of the Fleming Biomedical Sciences Research Centre in Athens, Greece, who told me all about his controversial take on the problem and why he thinks that our noses obey quantum rules.
My interest in smell was really started out with perfume, really. I actually wrote a guide to perfumes in the early 90s, and more recently another one. So I've always had an interest in fragrance as an art. And being a biophysicist, I started reading up on how the sense of smell was supposed to work. And it was pretty clear to me that the standard explanation didn't work very well.
So what's the standard picture of that, or how have people tried to typically understand that?
Well, the standard picture is in fact, on the face of it, perfectly reasonable. Most other molecular recognition mechanisms in biology, from antibodies to enzymes to, in fact, the standard neurotransmitter receptors, work in what's called a lock and key fashion. And so what that really means is that a molecule binds to a receptor, and the goodness of the fit dictates whether the receptor is turned on or not. So you'd expect from that for there to be a relationship between the shape of a molecule and its smell. And that's what's really been lacking in the field of olfaction. There is, in fact, no clear pattern in any instance between shape of molecules and smell.
So what's your sort of idea about this? What's your take on it?
So my take, which is really not my take, what I've done is I've revived a theory which has died several times since the 1930s when it was first proposed, which is a completely different approach to the problem, which is that the idea is that the nose, the receptor cells, what they probe is the molecular vibrations of the molecule. Now, on the face of it, this is a pretty crazy idea in the sense that, you know, we all know that a spectroscope, an infrared spectroscope, which is what is required to do that, is a machine about 3 foot by 4, which sits on your bench and weighs a couple of hundred pounds. And when you look up somebody's nose, you see no such thing. So that, on the face of it, is crazy. But it turns out that not only does it explain empirically some very basic phenomena about smell, but also it turns out that there is a biological way of doing that, which does not involve complicated optics or any such thing, and which is a sort of biological analog of color vision for smell.
So can you explain a bit more about what this biological way of doing it is? Because, you know, you've just made a very good point about how difficult it is to do.
So the notion that the only way to do spectroscopy is with optics has been, in fact, known to be wrong for a long time, since in 1966 it was discovered that you could do vibrational spectroscopy using electrons in nano devices, essentially. So this is called electron tunneling spectroscopy. And you can perfectly well measure the spectra of molecules with an electron tunneling spectroscope. What's interesting about the electron tunneling spectroscopy from a standpoint of a biologist is that it's not that difficult to do biologically, because proteins are constantly shifting electrons from one place to another. In fact, you know, as we, any living and breathing human has something like 100 amps of electron currents flowing through their mitochondria just to breathe, just the oxygen. So electrons are everywhere in biology. So it's not, just by using well-known bits and pieces that are available as, you know, to the biologist, you can build, at least in your mind, an electron tunneling spectroscope fairly straightforwardly. The thing is, you have to prove that that's what's happening in olfaction.
So how do you prove it? What kind of tests can you do?
There are two kinds of tests. One is to show that animals, including humans, can actually smell molecular vibrations, and that's one kind of test. And the other one is to prove that it's done by electron tunneling, and that's a different problem. So let me first deal with the first one. Can we smell molecular vibrations? The way you test that is actually very simple. You ask whether there's a difference in smell between molecules that have the same shape and different vibrations. Now you might say, well, how does one do that? It's actually quite easy. You use isotopes. If you replace the hydrogen, for example, atoms in a given molecule with deuterium atoms, you are essentially ending up with a molecule that has exactly the same three-dimensional shape. But the deuterium is twice as heavy as the hydrogen, so all the vibrational modes, which depends on the mass of the things that are moving, will be altered. So the question is, do those molecules smell different, yes or no? And the answer is, yes, to flies, they do. Flies can tell isotopes quite easily apart.
Okay, this is a slightly silly question, but how do you ask a fly what it can smell?
Well, flies are live or die, I mean, especially fruit flies, live or die on their sense of smell. I mean, the reason they end up in your glass of wine is because they have a very good sense of smell. So that you, if you put them in a tea maze, a classic tea maze, you know, with we have two arms of the maze and you have two different smells in the different arms, they go to one or the other arm and you can either reward them. Actually, rewarding them is difficult. You can punish them. You can shock their feet. And they will learn. And so the kind of experiments that we've done with my colleagues in Greece, and this is not my contribution, this is very much their genetics and behavior work, which has made this happen, is that we've trained flies to avoid, for example, a deuterated molecule of a pair of odorants, the deuterated one, and then we've exposed them to another deuterated and non-deuterated pair, and they seem to transfer the learning from one to the other. So they can smell something in the deuterated compounds which transfers from molecule to molecule. And this is the kind of evidence that we've been building. Of course, you can't ask them a direct question. But the upside is you can't influence them either.
And you've also done experiments with humans.
Yes. There are. We're now doing some experiments with humans using molecules which have lots of hydrogens in them. And the maximum number, as big as an odorant can be, and it appears that humans can also do this. This has been a very contentious issue, and so far, I think it's fair to say that using small molecules to humans, deuteration seems to have very little or no effect. But I think that the new work that we're doing now maybe goes beyond that, and we're documenting actual differences in smell.
So if you use small molecules, is there also a correspondingly small difference in the vibration, and that's why they can't detect it?
That's a very good question. It's not entirely clear what's going on there. My take on it is this. The CH bond, which is really what you're changing. I mean, when you replace deuterium for hydrogen, you're affecting all the vibrations that involve the CH bond. The CH bond is probably perceived rather weakly by the spectroscope. I mean, this is all hand-waving argument, really. We don't really know what's going on, but it certainly appears to be clear that the more hydrogens there are, the bigger the difference in smell when you put deuterium in a molecule.
What are the challenges there in terms of getting people to articulate what they're smelling?
Well, this is the last thing you want to do is to ask them to articulate. This is the problem. People are relatively inexperienced with certainly the language of smells, and they're not used to focusing on smell characters. So you can do it with expert panels, unquestionably. But if you want naive subjects, which is also always, I mean, it's better to have naive subjects. You know, it's a better proof. You have to break down you have to find a test which is as clear as day to anybody. And that's extremely hard. So for example, you have to say, does this smell of onions? People know what onions smell of. Or does this smell of rose? Yes or no? Okay. And many, many smell experiments get into trouble because the signal is really small. It's hard to get it out of the noise using naive subjects. And I think I suppose one of the things I brought to this problem was I am confident about assessing the smell of something, having spent a lot of time in the perfumery world. I know what I'm smelling. So to give you an example, there's a molecule which smells of sulfur, doesn't contain sulfur, but vibrates at the same frequency as sulfur, and it had in the literature been described as smelling of chocolate, okay, since its discovery, right? So that, and if you smell it, if you think that's chocolate, God help you, okay? So this is the sort of problem that has, you know, set the field back tens of years, that people don't pay attention to smell. So that's one edge that I had, certainly.
Okay, so you mentioned that there were sort of two types of tests or two things that you're looking for. So explain the second one.
Well, so the second one is much harder because you say, well, okay, suppose that you've convinced everybody that flies can smell molecular vibrations. How do you know? How do you prove? How do you know what? How do you find out what the mechanism actually is? And that's much, much harder. And at this point, we're trying to do it essentially by mutations. We think that we've identified within the receptor protein of flies the amino acids that do the electron transfer. We think we have a good guess as to what the source and the sink of the electrons are. And what we're doing right now is mutational experiments to alter those amino acids and see if the sense of smell disappears.
Okay, so where would this lead to ultimately? Is it just about trying to understand more about one of our senses on an intellectual level, or are there going to be practical applications? Would you be able to engineer specific smells?
Well, so smell is a rather peculiar part of biology, of biomedicine, insofar as there are virtually no medical problems that pertain to the sense of smell. I mean, if you lose your sense of smell, you get no interest at all from doctors, really, very much. So it has an intellectual interest. I mean, we'd like to know how it works. What the implications are is really too early to tell. Well, first of all, it's clearly a quantum mechanism, okay, because inelastic electron tunneling is not a classical phenomenon. So this has become, this idea that smell works by a quantum mechanism has become the sort of one of the few areas in biology where something manifestly quantum is happening. So there's a degree of interest about that, and I think a lot of people in the field hope that this is only the tip of the iceberg, that other quantum phenomena will become important in biology. This may or may not be the case, but you know, that's where we are now. But more generally, I would say that the moment you find a mechanism which does not work by lock and key, you raise a whole host of questions. Namely, to give you an example, are we absolutely sure that neurotransmitter receptors really do work by lock and key? This could be again the tip of the iceberg for other receptor systems. I don't think that vibrations will be very important across the board. I mean, the sense of smell has a very good reason to use vibrations, which is it's doing analytical chemistry, really. It's telling you what a molecule is made of, okay? I don't really think that neurotransmitter receptors need that kind of knowledge. But they could still be using physical phenomena beyond lock and key that we haven't looked at yet.
So this is a bit more of a sociological question, but you mentioned that this is an example of a biological process that involves quantum physics. When you're looking to the future, or even, you know, studying smell at the moment, is it difficult because perhaps you need people from different disciplines to work together? Would you be thinking about training people differently in the future?
Yes, I think there has been in the last few years an extraordinary rise in interest in the physical aspects of biology, which is largely fueled by the fact that a lot of very smart physicists are looking over to the green pastures of biology and thinking, well, you know, this looks interesting. Why don't we have something to do with that? So that's a new phenomenon. Are biologists comfortable with that? I'm not sure. I think the audience of quantum biology, as it's been called, is chiefly physicists at the moment. The biologists are not very much involved so far.
You know, you mentioned people who have lost their sense of smell. Can they help you in any way? Is there some way of using them to understand more about smell?
Yes, in fact, it's very interesting because the loss of sense of smell, which can be due to either trauma or a very bad cold and so on, it often comes back, the sense of smell, gradually. And what's very interesting is that it doesn't come back all in one piece. It comes back in bits and pieces. And some of these bits and pieces are really strange, and I believe there's an awful lot of information in there. Like, for example, I know that Molly Birnbaum, who's written a book about losing sense of smell and regaining it, a wonderful book, by the way, Molly Birnbaum's, the first thing she smelled was a version of rosemary, part of the rosemary smell. Now, I'm absolutely sure that whatever the theory that you subscribe to in smell, that has a meaning. Unfortunately, all this information on anosmias and parosmias and phantosmias and so on is dispersed, especially in Europe. There's no really good center for smell that collates all this information and has people thinking about it. So much of it is lost, really, to our understanding in science.
Can you talk a little bit more about the work that you've done with perfume? In that sort of maybe more commercial side of thinking about perfume, and would you be able to engineer specific smells?
Well, so one of the things that I've had a wonderful opportunity to do something that many scientists don't do, which is to reduce a theory to practice. For 8 years, I was CTO of a small startup company that created novel fragrance and flavor molecules based on vibrational calculations to help find new molecules. The idea was to design molecules which were somehow better in some respect or other, like, for example, not allergens or more powerful or whatever. That's been my involvement with perfumery. But to me, the fascination of being in that world is simply being able to pick something off the shelf and smell it. And the surprise is wonderful every time.
That was Luca Turin discussing quantum sniffery with Zia. His ideas really aren't mainstream, are they?
No, they aren't. But what's great about his work is that he is able to carry out lab experiments to test his ideas. We'll keep you updated on any new results his team have in the future.